people recognize that if you want to fly long distances and you want to do it very efficiently and land wherever the heck you want, get yourself a tilt rotor.
From the Defense and Aerospace Report, this is the Air Power Podcast, powered by GE Aerospace. I'm J.J. Gertler.
And I'm Vago Maradian. It's been a busy few months for tilt rotors. The U.S. Army committed to the V-280 Valor tilt rotor by Bell as its future battlefield transport after killing the second leg of its long-running future vertical lift program. Congress added five more CMV-22 carrier onboard delivery variants of the Osprey to the Navy's fleet as the entire V-22 force returned to flight after a deadly accident. And the Air Force Special Operations Command looks for a faster vertical takeoff and landing aircraft for its future needs. We'll get an update on all things V-22, V-280, and beyond from two experienced operators, Kurt Fuller and Rob Freeland of Bell. And how does a record-setting, globe-girdling solar aircraft become an ultra-ultra-ultra-long endurance reconnaissance platform? SkyDweller's CEO Robert Miller shares the story. And of course, this week's headlines in Air Power.
And it's all powered by GE. From America's first jet engine to revolutionary hypersonic technologies, GE Aerospace has been delivering firsts in propulsion for more than 100 years. Learn about the latest innovation at geaerospace.com.
And the Defense and Aerospace Report and its family of publications is brought to you by HII, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, Bell, Leonardo DRS, American Rheinmetall, and TE Connectivity. JJ, what's in the news this week on All Wings Considered?
Another hitch in F-35 deliveries. The jets that have been produced but parked in Fort Worth were supposed to start getting Technology Refresh 3 by the end of this month. Thanks to experience with the release out in the fleet, that retrofit has been postponed indefinitely. So countries like Denmark, who were looking to acquire early block F-35s from, well, anybody, just got a little more incentive for their search. Say arrivederci as Italy retires the AMX strike fighter after 35 years of service. This leaves Brazil as the last country operating the jet, at least until they get their Gripen purchase sorted out. Of course, much of Italy's strike mission is moving to the F-35, and upgrading an AMX is like taking a goldfish to the vet. And talk about putting faith in your product. Air Force Secretary Frank Kendall is going to fly later this year on an F-16. What's odd about that, you ask? It will be an AI-piloted F-16, part of the development of the collaborative combat aircraft. No word yet on whether the AI will also serve peanuts. Vago?
Okay, a couple of gems there. Goldfish to the vet, good one. And the AMX always was kind of a cool aircraft, so always sad to see something go, even if it's superseded. And everybody knows we're fans of Frank Kendall on this program, but boy, that's really leading from the front, isn't it?
Well, it's trying to show the service that this new technology that people may or may not really welcome is working and safe. And I think that's leadership taken to a whole new level.
If you're going to put the future of the force in the hands of an unmanned aircraft of the type they want for collaborative combat aircraft, and what I also think it's interesting, right? I mean, every indication is down select is going to be right around the corner, right? To the three companies that are going to go ahead. It was supposed to happen a couple of months ago. It was delayed a little bit to let one more competitor in. That other competitor was Anduril. What do you hear scuttlebutt-wise about when that down select decision is coming out?
Literally any day. We hear that that's coming up soon, and I wouldn't be surprised if Secretary Kendall's decision to participate in this little experiment is part of the rollout of that down select.
We look forward to him having a very successful flight and not becoming the first Air Force Secretary to eject from an F-16.
Either way, he'll have a good story to tell us next time he's on the program.
Yes, yes, indeed he will. And we wish the best. And we know in the hands of the U.S. Air Force, he's going to have a terrific flight. JJ, shall we get started with the program?
Let's do that.
Robert Miller is no stranger to advanced systems. He used to be part of Northrop Grumman's vaunted special projects team. He's now converting a historic airplane, the Solar Impulse, the first entirely solar-powered aircraft to make it all around the world. He's trying to convert it into a cutting-edge reconnaissance system, one that flies at 45,000 feet and stays aloft not just days, weeks, but potentially months. But it does it flying at 25 knots. Here's our interview with the CEO of the innovative company, SkyDweller. Robert, absolutely a fascinating program. First, give us a sense on how you ended up with what is, in 2012, history setting. Bertrand Piccard helped develop the aircraft to do the first solar flight around the world, had a 36-hour endurance. It's not particularly fast, but it is solar-powered. Give us a sense on how you ended up with ownership of the aircraft and the intellectual property rights before we get to the point about you guys trying to make it unmanned and a reconnaissance platform that can stay up not just days, but weeks and perhaps even months.
Well, I saw the need in some conversations with the U.S. Military and DARPA, the need for a platform that could carry significant payload, so more than 300 pounds, provide significant power, more than 2 kilowatts. And I was lucky enough to be introduced to Bertrand Piccard and André Borschberg, who flew the Solar Impulse. It does hold the longest solo flight of any aircraft of any kind. So it flew for 5 days from Japan to Hawaii with one pilot. And in September of 2019, with my business partner, J.D. Parks, and some help from some bankers, we were able to raise the money and purchase the Solar Impulse 2 aircraft and all intellectual property associated with it.
I think the story is pretty incredible that, you know, DARPA had a requirement, and so you went around the world to try to find an aircraft that could satisfy the requirement because the helicopter, you know, was sort of best suited for it, but unfortunately lacked the kind of endurance that was needed. What's the hole in the global surveillance market you see that you guys are trying to address, right? I mean, because there are a lot of systems out there. General Atomics is one of our sponsors. Obviously, they've got the Predator family, but there are other guys around the world who are sort of trying to get a 24-hour, 36-hour kind of reconnaissance capability aloft, if not longer. What's the sweet spot you guys are shooting at, and how big do you think that market is?
I think that market is very large. We're talking about an aircraft that flies for days instead of hours, okay? So the total endurance is measured in weeks and months instead of just hours or nautical miles. I mean, imagine an aircraft that you can fly from San Diego all the way to the Spratlys, does surveillance there for 3 or 4 weeks and flies all the way back. There is a gap right now in that capability, especially if you look beyond, say, 1,000 nautical miles from a forward operating base, that there is really nothing out there that can cover that except maybe the Navy Triton or the Air Force Global Hawk. It becomes very unaffordable to try to do surveillance at those longer ranges. And a lot of places in the world right now, when you think about the Pacific Ocean, the Western Pacific, the distances are huge. It's 2,000 nautical miles from Guam to the Spratlys. And think about Hawaii to the Spratlys. So there's a huge gap there. Also, when you think about the Sahel, you know, we've had problems. We've lost special forces people because of the lack of ISR coverage in Africa. And there just aren't a lot of forward operating bases there. I mean, the coup in Niger is putting our base at Agadez at risk. So there's a huge gap right now in this ability to project very long range ISR.
And roughly what altitude and what speed are we talking about, right? Because it's not necessarily the fastest aircraft in the world. As you said, it took 5 days to get across the Pacific.
So our max altitude with this version of the aircraft will be about 40, 45,000 feet. And then like all solar powered aircraft, you go up and down during the day. And so at night you'll go down, and we'll go down to approximately 10,000 feet at night. And we fly at 25 knots sea level. So we don't fly very fast, but if you're below 25 degrees latitude, so plus or minus 25 degrees latitude around the world, you'll find that our ability to station keep over a particular point on the globe is very, very high.
And, you know, you have talked about all the changes you made to the system, right? I mean, it used to be pushrod operated and the like, right? I mean, you're making changes to the original aircraft. Obviously, it's something that you want to put in production. What does the productionized version of the aircraft look like? And when are we likely to see it? Because you guys, congratulations, you guys also had your first unmanned flight from Stennis, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes. So we conducted our first unmanned flight out of Stennis, Mississippi. We've been doing optionally piloted autonomous flights, so basically human cargo flights. And then we were able to work all the necessary paperwork that once we brought the aircraft here to Stennis, Mississippi, that we were able to fly completely without anybody in the cockpit. So it's completely uncrewed now. It's a completely unmanned aircraft now. So what are we going to see in the future? Well, we're going to continue to add redundancy to our fly-by-wire system. And it's a full fly-by-wire system, no revision, man-rated, obviously, because we were flying with man in it. And we'll see that going from dual redundancy all the way to quad redundancy. We're going to see better batteries, better solar cells. There's a few, I would say, next generation manufacturing technologies with composites that you'll see. And all that will increase the performance of the aircraft. So the aircraft works now. It's a great product, but you're going to see as batteries and solar cells over the next 5-10 years get better. And we continue to see some improvements in aerospace composites, that this aircraft, the performance is really going to step up.
And what does a supercharged solar impulse look like from a performance standpoint?
Well, a supercharged Sky Dweller looks pretty similar to what it is today, okay? Except that it's going to be able to operate at higher latitudes, say plus or minus 30 degrees latitude, 365 days a year, carrying that 300 to 800 pounds of payload and 2+ kilowatts of power continuously.
Let me ask you one other question, right? I mean, price is an important quotient to this. In order to have a solar-powered aircraft, you're generally looking for something that's even lighter than the engineering for a regular airplane. You know, there are some people who are going to say, look, I mean, some of these things are really boutique, very delicate products, as we saw, for example, from the Voyager and other aircraft. How do you guys get that balance of robustness? You know, and folks are going to shoot at it, right? I mean, presumably when it comes to any reconnaissance system. So replaceability is another thing. How are you working the cost side of the equation as well as the robustness and reliability? And what are you learning in the course of flight tests that'll make subsequent versions more durable and work down the cost curve?
A couple of things to unpack in that question, though. So the first thing is we're a robust aircraft. We pass the Part 23 gust load requirements that you'd see for any aircraft. Additionally, we have over 1,300 flight hours in what I would call the solar aircraft death zone, a perfect safety record in that death zone of 5 to 30,000 feet where you're going to hit the most turbulence when you're flying an aircraft. And that's the same death zone that has killed the Helios, Zephyr, all the Google and Facebook failed attempts, you know, and you know, we're a team. This isn't our first or second or third time to this rodeo. We've worked on a lot of large UAVs. My team has an extensive background, and we're not there to build a science project. We're there to build an operational system. So when we design this system, we're designing it to handle the corner conditions, because if you're going to fly for millions of hours, bad stuff happens. And so you got to deal with that. Because making the aircraft fly autonomously is not necessarily the hardest thing. It's making it fly when not one, but two, but three things go wrong and it comes home and lands safely. So from that perspective, you know, we're working a truly robust operational system. And from a cost perspective, you buy aircraft by the pound. You can plot all aircraft, max gross takeoff with the price, and you'll see there's a nice curve there. We think we will be very competitive. And then additionally, it's the operational cost that is really going to be a huge change here. You got to think of it, instead of maintenance hours per flight hour, you're going to have flight hours per maintenance hour.
Just one last thing about the tests and upcoming tests, right? You've done your first one. What does the testing schedule look like? And roughly, when do you think you're going to be able to bring an operational capability online?
I think by the end of the summer, we'll be able to bring an operational capability online. That should be in the late summer. We're going to see now a gradual ramp up in the performance of the aircraft. So the number of hours that it flies, and we're going to be achieving multi-day flight this summer over the Gulf of Mexico.
And any customers yet lining up for the service?
We are under contract with the U.S. military, U.S. Navy. We do have a JCTD. I can't yet announced some things, but we do have contracts with some Western allies as well, and we'll be able to announce more information about that in the future.
Robert, all the best to you and your team. I've been tracking you guys for some time. I thought the solar impulse was just one of the most incredible aircraft in history. It's great to see it being put to good use. I'm surprised the Smithsonian didn't get its hooks into the program before you guys were able to take it over. But hopefully one of these days, eventually it'll end up, you know, making even more history and being enshrined in a different way. All the best of luck to you and your team.
Thank you. And I do hope to see it one day in the Smithsonian as well.
And don't miss the other weekly podcasts on the Defense and Aerospace Report Network. Cavis Ships, hosted by Naval Savant's Chris Cavis and Chris Cervello, and sponsored by GE Aerospace. They clear the fog on naval and maritime matters. The Downlink, with space guru Laura Winter, who takes a thoughtful look at all things galactic. And our Technology Report, digging deep into cyber, chips, AI, and more. It's hosted by Vago Maradian.
And now the latest on V-22 and tilt rotor technology, our discussion with Kurt Fuller and Rob Freeland of Bell.
Kurt, you've been with V-22s in various positions for a very long time, seen the whole history. It's been up, it's been down. The latest news, though, is probably up. Congress has asked for five more CMV-22s. What does that do for the program and for the line?
That's right, JJ. Just here in FY24, Congress did add five more V-22s, CMV-22s to be specific. So that's phenomenal for the tilt rotor industrial base as well as for Bell Boeing. So it's going to keep the line going for a couple more years. I think it's reflective of the value that Congress sees and what the tilt rotor brings to the fight and the fact that the Navy needs a few more aircraft.
And does that also build you a bridge to improvement programs to evolve the V-22 farther, such as within the cells?
Actually, you run in parallel for us. So it does keep the bridge going to support the FVL stand-up. But in addition, we've got a program called Nacelle Improvements where we're bringing currently Air Force CV-22s back into Amarillo, retrofitting the nacelles in those aircraft. And that program's been going very well. We've got over 4,000 flight hours on that platform, on that configuration, and have saved over 10,000 maintenance man hours for the Navy.
And do five aircraft get you far enough to go heel-to-toe with V-280?
It certainly is in the right direction. We're continuing in efforts such as the nacelle improvement mods, as well as other mods we're looking at on other programs will get us that bridge that we need.
And tell the audience a little bit who might be wondering about the nacelle improvement program, what that exactly entails and why that's such a priority.
Yeah, great question. So several years ago, you know, when V-22 had about 400,000 flight hours on it, we had a tremendous amount of data. We took that data and what we identified was most of the maintenance was done in the nacelles on the V-22. We took all that data and then we partnered with the Marine Corps and the Air Force maintainers to get firsthand knowledge of where their pain points were. We coupled all that with a redesign of the nacelle. We changed the wiring architecture. We changed the design of the harnesses to make it more robust for the environment that we now understand for a tilt rotor nacelle, and we change the structure to give them better access to the areas that they need to gain access more frequently. So we bring those aircraft in, we pull the nacelles off, we put in brand new structure, brand new wiring harnesses, we reuse the stuff like the engines and the gearboxes, and we bolt that back on the aircraft, and in less than 2 months, the aircraft's back in the fleet doing what it needs to do.
Let me take you to the question of the incident. There was a crash off the Japan coast, a U.S. Air Force Special Operations aircraft that unfortunately crashed off of Japan, killing seven aboard. Everything that we know, and I know the investigation is continuing, and you guys are working with the Marine Corps, the Navy, as well as the Air Force on it. Our understanding is that the part that failed was something that is not normally a part that would fail. And that Japanese press have reported that the crew requested an emergency landing repeatedly and were unfortunately not given that clearance. And so in that delay, unfortunately, the aircraft went down. And anytime there's an incident that involves the V-22, it has a tendency of dredging up every other incident that ever happened, unfortunately, with the program. What do we know about what happened? How does it affect the program? Do we know whether or not there are engineering changes, whether it's going to be process changes, whether inspection changes? You know, where are we right now?
Yeah, so the investigation is still ongoing with Air Force, AFSOC Special Operations Forces. When that report comes out, eventually, then we'll get the final details. But what they have identified is, as you said, a particular failure. That coupled with the history we have on the platform of the 750,000 flight hours, we were able to partner with the government, and they instituted some maintenance and operational procedures that allowed the fleet to get back flying, and they just did that about a month ago. And as you've seen probably here recently in the media, the Navy and the Marine Corps are back actively flying V-22s.
every time an incident like this happens, obviously there may be some people who might be interested in undermining the idea of a tilt rotor, for example. You know, given that it is a game-changing capability, it's unique, it has different and indeed added maintenance in some respects, and that's the reason why the V280 looks fundamentally different, and Rob will talk to us about that in just a moment. What can you tell the audience about what the reality of the platform and its safety rating? If you listen to the Marine Corps, it's right in the middle of any Marine Corps aircraft, ultimately, in a safety record. What is it, as somebody who's been associated with the program for a while, and Rob, if you want, as an early cadre V-22 guy, if you want to pitch in on this as well, what is it folks need to know about what the reality of its safety reliability is, as opposed to maybe people's mental model, which might be a little bit different than reality?
Yeah, certainly. So V-22 is the first operational tilt rotor that's out there flying around the world today, right? And so with any first generation aircraft, we continually to, you know, get data off of that, learn from that, improve it. But that being said, even being a first generational aircraft of its type, you look at it on the Marine Corps side and its safety record is right in the midst of all the other Marine Corps aircraft. So it's got a proven track record of being a safe aircraft and an extremely capable aircraft, you know, with the range and speed of fixed wing, but the ability to have runway independence like a helicopter.
I think Kurt hit it pretty well. I think, you know, you talk about a V-22 and all the wonderful lessons that you've learned over the years. This goes back 70 years. I mean, we go back into the XV-3 in the 50s, the XV-15 in the 70s, and now you had this first operational tilt rotor. All the things that we learned that inform something like nacelle improvement, well, all that you roll into that basic design on the 280. So you end up right up front solving all of your aeromechanical issues, having something that's inherently reliable, really improving the affordability. And it takes a tilt rotor and makes it available to a much broader swath of not only U.S. services, but our partner nations.
Now, this is first generation technology, and that leads us to the second generation. The V-280 Valor was selected by the U.S. Army for its future long-range assault aircraft. You've had a few months since that to let the party hangover wear off. Where's the program today, and when will we start to see aircraft coming off the line?
Yeah, and I, you know, good joke, but no party hangover. The whole point is the Army did a really good job of learning about tilt rotors again. You know, the Army was involved with tilt rotors back in the 50s. The Army was the original lead on the V-22 when it was JVX. So the Army's always wanted this. Now, the Army got to see during JMR, Joint Multirole Tech Demonstration, with the V-280, Air Vehicle Concept Demonstrator, it was like a 9-year conversation. They got to learn exactly where the requirement knees in the curve lay. They got to understand what the core characteristics were. So they knew that they were getting into an affordable, reliable aircraft that they could spread across their large fleet. Because let's remember, the Army has the largest air force in the world. So large fleet affordability is their imperative. Now, we're progressing very well with the development. It's nice to have moved into a collaborative phase with the Army. The competition is done. You know, people recognize that if you want to fly long distances and you want to do it very efficiently and land wherever the heck you want, get yourself a tilt rotor. Because that wing and the axial thrust, that's how you get out to those distances, a turboprop that hovers. So Army's now making this their own, making this their long-range assault aircraft. Bell is honored and really excited to take these next steps with the Army, and that probably leads into a conversation of what the other services are doing right behind them.
Why, funny enough, Rob, that would be the question, right? Every single time I've seen you guys brief on the program, there have always been Marines who've been hanging around, whether we've been at AUSA or anywhere else. And even when you guys had the model here occasionally in the past, there would be a lot of interest around it. Obviously, right, as opposed to tilting the whole nacelle, you guys have figured out a different way to keep the engines from tilting, make that a much more reliable, easier maintenance. What do the Marines want out of the program? How does V-280 build to it? I know the 247 is another airplane, an unmanned aircraft you guys have proposed. That's a tilt rotor, which the Marines had, you know, high aspirations for as well. How does this program bridge to the other services?
So what you're starting to see is, you know, the realization of the vision for future vertical lift. This whole idea Congress had set in motion, you know, back in the 2000s, saying, listen, we know that you're going to have to recapitalize your rotorcraft fleets over the next 30 to 50 years.
let's make sure we get the requirements right. Let's make sure we're all the services are talking to each other, that we find a way to leverage each other's development investments, and then tune that solution to the needs of the services. So that's what we're doing right now. The Army is in the lead. So lead service, multi-service participation, and the Army is developing that basic long-range assault aircraft. They're going to have a medevac variant, they're going to have SOCOM variants, and they're moving out. Now, what we do is we get into these conversations with the other services, and for example, you know, here at Sea Airspace, let's talk about Navy and Marine Corps. Both Navy and Marine Corps have identified that they want a manned solution and an unmanned solution, and they want them to work together. And then they decompose the missions, you know, within their functions of aviation and reallocate to these different platforms. Because when you have an unmanned system that leverages all these technologies, these critical technologies that we've demonstrated, it's almost like you start much further along in the development process because there's less discovery. We've already got a lot of this stuff figured out. You know, all these aeromechanical things that we discovered on V-22 and then, you know, have seen more reliability things that you want to work on over the first 20 years of operations, all rolled into that basic long-range assault. Now, Marine Corps, Navy, what are your missions? What is it you want to do? We know a lot about what you're doing, but tell us, refine this design so that it answers your needs. Do you have different range, different things you want to carry? And then we bring those designs back to them.
And those services are in the room, but very importantly, this is not a joint program as it currently sits. What's the nature of their participation and their contribution as this goes along, or is it principally observing and working out their answers to those questions you just mentioned?
So a couple parts to answer to that. I'm not going to presuppose how the Navy and Marine Corps are going to define their participation. They will take care of that. However, I will tell you that if you want to look around at systems commands, who has a lot of experience with tilt rotors, it's NAVAIR. So NAVAIR's been involved with the Army. I mean, their services sharing information with each other, sharing expertise. And they've had watched Joint Multirole Tech Demonstration. Now they're watching the development. So a lead service who's putting the money in and putting the time in to develop that basic airframe, and then others are very conscious of where they might make adjustments to that design. And that'll be their service decision on how they move forward. But in this collaborative space where you get to have the open conversations, okay, you want to add this, you want to add that, here's what that looks like. And they make conscious decisions, just like the Army did, about what they need to do to solve their service-specific warfighting needs.
Let me go back to the capability as you guys are envisioning it, right? Nobody has more experience in terms of being the tilt rotor company than you guys do. Obviously, Boeing knows a thing or two, but you guys are the iron core of that, especially as you go to the next generation, seeing as how you competed against Boeing and Sikorsky to win the FLRAA program. Kurt and Rob, if you want to weigh in on this, when the Air Force Special Operations Commander says, General Barnfind, that he wants to get to a next-generation tilt rotor that is much bigger, right? He says, you know, bigger than a Black Hawk is great, and the range is great, and the speed is great, but we need something significantly bigger if we're going to be doing island hopping in the Pacific. You know, and he comes from a C-130 background, and being able to lug around 30,000 pounds of cargo is something that you might get used to after a while, and also be able to do it at range and roughly that kind of speed. What does the future look like as you guys look notionally down there, right? I mean, we've all seen the graphics of quad rotors and things like that. What's the future you guys are envisioning when a general officer like that is looking for a long-term capability?
Yeah, great question. So as you mentioned, quad tilt rotors, we've done a lot of studies on the Bell side about tilt rotor technology and how to apply that to different air vehicles, if you will, everything as large as a C-130 type fuselage that drove the quads. And one of the things that AFSOC has expressed is an interest in the capability of a tilt rotor, but at much higher speed. And so if you look at what DARPA's doing right now with their Sprint program, they're challenging that, you know, looking at what's the capability that we can push to have the runway independence like a tilt rotor, but have much higher speeds. And so we're actively working that, and it's not new technology for us. We first tested some of that in a wind tunnel back in the 70s. And so our stop fold, or as we call high-speed VTOL, we believe is definitely the right solution for what they're looking to do for speed and runway independence.
how much of that work depends on the Army deciding formally to take up another of the FVL capability sets? They had, as one of their possible configurations, a large quad tilt rotor. They decided to put that kind of at the end of the line. Is that an active collaboration with them, or is Bell going ahead on its own to define a design?
So I'll let Rob chime in if he's got more to add. But right now we're working directly with DARPA. So DARPA's sponsored some development efforts that we're working through right now that range from everything from a smaller unmanned to a larger manned type vehicle for a high-speed VTOL, as we call it, or stop-fold configuration, which is the solution we've come up with. So.
And how do you get to those speeds? I should have said, right, I mean, the boss was talking about something, a significantly higher speed capability, right, given the sheer distances that are involved, right? I mean, 300 knots, 300 plus knots is great, 500 knots is better. What are some ways to try to achieve that speed, given that right now we're pushing the far end of what a rotor blade is going to be able to do for you?
Right, so the solution that Bell has identified, and again goes back 40 plus years of testing that we've done with stop fold, is once you get on airplane mode and you get the efficiency of the wing, the best thing you can do is get those big prop rotors out of the airstream because they're a drag aspect. And so the technology there is to fold those prop rotors and then have an engine that provides jet thrust versus relying on the prop rotors.
And let me ask one last sustainability question, right? I mean, the V-22, no matter whether we're transitioning to a 280 and it gets adopted, right? I mean, the tilt rotor will be with us for several decades longer. You guys are constantly learning lessons on how to do things better. In fact, your Lift Advanced Technology Center is helping pioneer some of those technologies that you're drawing from V-22, putting them into V-280, and then spinning them back out to the V-22 force. Kurt, what does that look like as you're gaining more flight hours and basically it's an airplane that's going to be around for a very long time?
Absolutely. Marine Corps has been pretty clear that they intend to keep V-22s in the fight well into the 2055 and possibly even beyond. You know, the Navy is just getting started with the CMV, so they're going to be around for quite a while. So we're absolutely here to support that aircraft and what it needs to keep it relevant in the next several decades. And so as we do that and we look at where our whether it be obsolescence issues, as we get more flight hours on the aircraft and learn more about, you know, reliability concerns or capability that the customer needs. And we're constantly taking that data, taking that customer feedback, and looking at what's the art of the possible for upgrades to the platform, and then coordinating with our teammates on FLARA of what have they already done, what of that technology makes sense to pull back into V-22, cut down on that learning curve, and expedite solutions to the fleet.
And we've been talking a lot about the air vehicle, but another big part of this development is the modularized open system approach to the architecture, this open architecture digital backbone.
The MOSA approach.
Yes, so the open systems approach, and we have an open architecture digital backbone. So that's a big part of what the Army is doing. Well, everybody wants to have open architectures. So again, leveraging each other's developments, the whole vision of Future Vertical Lift, not just the air vehicle, which we've got dialed in pretty well, but also this open architecture that Bell and its partner GE Aviation were providing this as infrastructure on the aircraft, because we know that this is what really breaks it open from an obsolescence and from a life cycle sustainment standpoint. And we are committed to making sure that the services have that on their aircraft.
Any international sales in the offing?
So we got our current customer with Japan, obviously the Japan Ground Self-Defense Force that's operating. They bought their fleet of 17 aircraft, and right now that's from an FMS case. That's the primary focus right now for V-22.
Any additional customers coming up before the line closes? You guys are doing a move now, get it. Kurt will give you a good price. Rob will give you the recommendation, come into the dealership.
How much money you got, Vago? You want to buy a V-22?
I would love that to be my private aircraft, but then again, I'm just a humble reporter, Kurt. What about governments out there? Do you think there's going to be some more international sales before the line wraps up?
You know, timing is a challenge right now. Certainly, there's a lot of countries out there that have got interest. They see the value that a tilt rotor brings. It's a matter of marrying up when their needs are, their requirements are, with their fiscal budget availability. And so we'll see how things go, but they need to act pretty quickly if they want to get in before the line shuts down.
I think the biggest conversation piece now, the beauty is
realizing the potential, the vision of future vertical lift, having services leverage each other's development. And, you know, they're going to help each other. Someone's going to pick up the 247. Others are going to be able to use it. And not just between the Navy and Marine Corps. You know, the Coast Guard could see application for this. Other services, other countries can see application for this. So it's really getting tilt rotors for everybody. It's spreading out that tilt rotor industrial base, getting more people involved in the tilt rotor family, because we will collectively now have this overmatched capability in the quantities, in the mass required to have a significant overmatch effect on our adversaries.
Let me just ask one follow-up question, and maybe, Rob, you're the best person to answer on this because you have been scarred for some time with the Future Vertical Lift program, even though you're not celebrating too loudly. The second part of Future Vertical Lift, the first part was the Future Long-Range Assault Aircraft, the second part was the Future Armed Reconnaissance Aircraft. That program was curtailed. Do you still feel comfortable and confident that, you know, because there were some who said, hey, look, you know, the Army gave assurances to the companies and they felt pretty confident that program was going to go ahead, and at the last minute it changed. And for some it was like, well, you say you want to support the 280 and the Future Long-Range Assault Aircraft, but we thought you were supportive of the Future Armed Reconnaissance Aircraft too. Do you feel comfortable and confident that the 280 part of the program is going to move ahead, even if some worry that a very important part of it did go away?
Absolutely, I feel comfortable with long-range assault moving forward. If you look at the Army's operating concepts, and you go back and read the Chief Staff of the Army papers from General McConville, he spoke over and over about the need for organic resupply, the need to put the enemy in the horns of a dilemma, to have an overmatch speed and range capability. That's not going to go away. And the need to have humans on the battlefield. What do humans do better than machines? They can judge. They have human curiosity. They can handle randomness. So we still need to get humans out there to the edge, and I'm confident it's still a mission for the Army, and they're going to find other ways to get it done. But absolute confidence in long-range assault moving forward, because remember, the Army is doing this initial development, but they're the lead service with multi-service participation. There are lots of other folks following in trace who also need the speed and range that's inherent with the tilt rotor, and now with the open architecture to make obsolescence and life cycle sustainment much cheaper.
How much different is the final aircraft than the one you guys were developing in the 280 demonstrator that was flying around?
I don't think it's my place to tell you what the Army's requirements are and how they're going to refine that. What I will tell you is that anytime you get a chance for another bite at the apple, another chance to prototype, it'll be better and better. So it's a refined version of what we were able to demonstrate very successfully. Because remember, that Joint Multirole Tech Demonstration aircraft, it flew 3 times a day, flew 8 times in a week. It's an inherently reliable aircraft built from the ground up to be affordable.
Kurt Fuller, Rob Freeland from Bell, thanks so much for joining us on the Air Power Podcast.
Thanks so much for joining us on the Air Power Podcast. And if you liked what you heard, hey, tell a friend, unless you think it would give them a competitive advantage. Thanks also to GE Aerospace for powering the entire flight. We'll be back next week.